Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. The great Gambon, Michael Gambon in his own words and others, is a new book, a fascinating new book about one of my favourite actors. It is by Millie Ellis, and she had a very particular and special part to play in the life of the great Gambon. And I'm delighted to say that Millie joins us live on the line. I believe for your is this your first radio interview ever, Millie, by the way?
I'm afraid it is, Giles, so apologies to your listeners if I'm a little bit, let's say, hesitant at times, but I'll try my best.
Absolutely. Well, that's the spirit. And I must say, I'm very impressed. The listeners can't see this, but if that is not a Zoom background, that is an actual living, breathing library, and we like a good bookshelf.
Oh, gosh, thank you. Very much indeed. So I want you to thank you very, very much, Giles, and your listeners for having me on today, because I feel very privileged to talk about the great Gambon.
Because one of the things is, I mean, listeners will probably be bored to tears about this, but as a teenager, as we all did, I harboured dreams of treading the boards, etc. Did all the drama schools, but one of the books that I read was Anthony Scher's The Year of the King, his book about when he played Richard III, you know, the crooked spider, etc. And he's got this great story of waiting in the line at the RSC canteen and then suddenly shouting, "Oh, Tony," and looking around and it's Michael Gambon. And he goes into, "Now is the winter of our discontent." And I thought that was a little sort of, and Tony Scher was also a brilliant artist, and he did this wonderful picture of Gambon sort of in the queuing up for his food, but going full Richard II. So it struck me that he wasn't pretentious. It wasn't, you know, "I am an actor and I am Sir." So I really wanted to hear a little bit more about his life, which is what your book does. How did you first meet him?
So there is a very funny story about Richard III, which we could go on to a bit later. But how did I first meet him? Well, it's best if I wrap it into a little story. So we're in Elstree. It's 1989. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. And all the Winnebagos are bristling with bacon sarnies. And the actors, Tim Roth, Kieran Hines, and others, there's Roger Lloyd-Pack and Ewan Stewart and Gary Olsen, they're all getting ready for their part in Peter Greenaway's revenge tragedy, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover. It is early in the morning and they're all talking very urbanely about their weekend when suddenly the air is shattered. The calm is completely disturbed by this BMW that screeches into the car park, does several laps, and then out of the window comes this bacchanal scream, this howl, "Where's my boys?" And out of the car erupts this terrifying presence that is Albert Speaker, the thief. of the cook, the thief, his wife and her lover. Helen Mirren is his wife and Alan Howard is the lover and Richard Boringer is the cook. And that is how I first met Gambon, exploding into our lives.
Were you preparing the bacon sandwiches? Were you in the film yourself? Were you just hanging around Winnebago's on the off chance?
I was rushing around with cups of tea and bacon sandwiches for the actors as I was a little assistant director, which is how I first came in contact with Michael. Because as little assistant directors in those days, I'm sure to today, you had someone allocated to make sure the actors were looked after, help maybe with their lines, help to prepare themselves to go on set. So that's how I met Michael.
And it must have been, it is an incredible film. It's almost like a Renaissance painting, isn't it? A Baroque painting. And it's just a lot of people don't get it, especially the final scene, you know,
tragedy.
Yeah.
The thing is, it's a revenge tragedy. So it's violent. It's very violent. It's beautiful, but it's also, as is Greenaway's wont, you know, a very complicated and disturbing film. But Michael, of course, stepped into it because he loved the drama. And there is a story, if I can just go off piece a moment.
You can go as off piece as you want, Millie. If they know my style, off piece is where I live.
Oh, well, that's wonderful because when he first got the script from Greenaway, he went to visit the dying Sir Laurence Olivier in his cottage in Sussex. And Lady Plowright opened the door and said, Michael, you can go and see Sir Laurence, but be very calm. He's not well, please. And Michael said, no, I'll be calm. And he goes in to see the dying. And Sir Laurence says, what are you up to at the moment, dear boy? And he said, I've just got this script. And he said, well, what is it? And he said, well, it's a script about this man who's got not one redeeming quality. And Florence said, oh, really? What's that? And he said, well, he's a gangster and he finds out his wife is having an affair and he discovers where he's hiding and he stuffs him full of paper. And then, and Sir Laurence is sitting up and he's going, yes, yes. And then what happens? And he goes, and then, of course, he kills him and then his wife cooks him and forces the bastard, to eat him. And Sir Laurence jumps up and goes, that's my part, I've got to play it. So this poor dying man jumps out of bed, tries to phone his agent and dies shortly after.
But I can't really see, with the greatest of respect to Sir Laurence, him playing the part that Gambon put. Because the great thing about the great Gambon is he could, you know, Sir Laurence was old school. He was, you know, it was Gielgud, it was Olivier, etc. And Gambon fits into that post-war where you're thinking Burton, O'Toole, you know.
Schofield.
Exactly. He is perhaps the less known of the Hellraisers, but because when you see Olivier, it's always Olivier playing that, whereas Gambon could step into the role and inhabit the role, because that's why so many sort of the younger listeners will just go Harry Potter and that's kind of it.
I know. But the thing about Michael that is so interesting for younger people to understand and realise is that he started in the 60s with the National Theatre and went and auditioned to Olivier. And for that generation of actors, we're talking Sir Derek Jacobi, we're talking Helen Mirren, we're talking Maggie Smith, we're talking Anthony Hopkins. They all were enthralled by Sir. Sir Laurence Olivier was always Sir to these actors. And he took the theatre from the Old Vic to the South Bank, which became the National Theatre.
Did Olivier do an awful lot of sort of making it more popular? Because before then, theatre had been, you know, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and not the Royal Shakespeare Company as it is today. It was very formal. Whereas the National Theatre, by its very name, it was bigger. There were more stages. And you've got, you know, say, Judi Dench, Ian McKellen, more Albert Finney, We have more and more working class type actors. And at the same time in cinema, of course, that's being taken over by people like Michael Caine. You've got Malcolm McDowell. You've got even Sean Connery to a certain extent. It's becoming more and more of its time and more of the people.
Well, that's a really interesting thought because, of course, the writers were changing, weren't they? You had Harold Pinter, you had David Hare, you had Alan Ayckbourn, you had people who were writing about the society they lived in and what was happening. And one of Michael's greatest relationships in his life was always with writers. He loved writers. He loved Harold Pinter, he loved Brian Friel, he loved Alan Ayckbourn, Carol Churchill. He absolutely worshipped at the shrine of Beckett, and he was an actor's friend, a writer's friend, I should say. And so writers loved him, and also they were in awe of the fact that, you know, John Dexter, the great director of Galileo, said of Michael, even though he's not an intellectual actor, he was incredibly intuitive, so that he was able to inhabit the characters and make them real. So that when it came to someone like Dennis Potter, and if your listeners have never watched The Singing Detective, I implore them to. In The Singing Detective, Michael was in a bed having to portray a man who was crippled with this terrifying arthritic disease. And yet, in his imagination, he was playing a detective. And this role broke him into the mainstream, along with another play, Galileo, which was a Brecht, which he played. And it was the first time that he did it to tumultuous applause on stage. But as he walked off stage in towards the dressing room, every single actor in the building applauded him. So that he became at that moment what's known as the great Gambon. Ralph Richardson, Sir Ralph Richardson, one of the old brigade, called Gambon the great Gambon, which is where I got the title from. And he also gave Michael a magical stone. And he said, Michael, I want you to carry this magical stone. This stone is going to ground you and make you a great actor. Michael carried it through King Lear. And it helped him in King Lear. And I remember once I asked him if I could hold the stone. And he went, no, Mugwai, you can't hold the stone. You'll become an actor. Nobody bloody wants that. So that was his stone until the very end. And the last conversation we ever had on the phone, when he was very ill, he said, because he always called me Mugwai, he said, Mugwai, I've lost the stone. Where's the stone, Mugwai? And that was a really extraordinary moment. So, you know, you go, actors are, you know, they're born out of their situation and their generation. Of course they are. But they also, if they're like Michael, they vacillate towards the writers that can help them really embody and exemplify what it is about writing that they can inhabit best.
How did he approach it? Because as every young man wants to do Hamlet, because that's the standard, if you like, of the Shakespeare's. I mean, Lear is a physical role. It is the one that everybody an actor of a certain age wants to take on. Were you around when he was taking on that? Did he talk about taking on Lear? I mean, because his Lear, you can just see the physicality of the role, you know, and his wonderful face. You can just imagine how he prepared for it and the performance itself.
Well, he prepared for it, apparently, by going just outside London to an airstrip, because he was a pilot, and he would howl at the planes as they started to land. So there must have been some extraordinary scenes of this raging lunatic howling of planes coming in. And apparently he was the storm. He became the storm because he was so brilliant at understanding the human condition. And I think as Lear, he got very close to understanding madness, to understanding what it would be like to go into a different realm, to find yourself, if you like, lost in the terror of an overwhelming emotion. And I often thought of Michael like a pearl diver, because he could dive into the very rich depths of the human condition and come up with something extraordinary, because he was such a great observer. You know, he was such an he was a shy man, and he was a man who was very, very private, but he was a consummate observer of people and of things. And he was also, Giles, to go off piste again, he often talked about his other lives, because he was a very complicated man. You know, he loved to talk about the time he was an apprentice at Holland & Holland as a gunsmith. He loved to talk about his watch collection, his analog watches. He could mend watches, even though he had enormous hands. And that somehow he could do intricate things with watches. He could be under the bonnet of a car in between takes, taking cars apart. He was a mechanic. He was a musician. He could do the most exquisite inlay of handguns, beautiful handguns. He taught himself how to do inlay. So Michael was a very, very interesting private man who was a genius.
Because the thing is, I suppose, in a world where actors were getting to Stanislavski, method acting, the whole thing, I am the character, you think of like Hoffman, etc. And so, or Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, I'm going to play, you know, Last of the Mohicans, so I'm going to walk around with a musket for like 4 or 5 years before the role itself. But to have another interest that doesn't involve carousing, as it did with, say, O'Toole or Harris or whatever else, it just goes to show that he was always curious. And for an actor, that has to be you have to be curious with the role, because then you bring something fresh and new to it. And also,
he was fascinated.
Yeah,
he was fascinated in things. I mean, I'm not saying that he didn't go on the lash with the lads at Buxton Club, because he did. You know, when he was playing, if I may for a moment go back to Albert Speaker, because he'd hung out with the Crays and O'Toole and, you know, the boys in the East End, he knew exactly what caliber gun the thief would carry. So he had decided that he'd been shot through the hip. He knew which caliber of bullet had shattered his hip, so he filed his shoe down so that he had the right gait for the part. He knew what he was carrying in his pocket, a fork, because he'd bought a restaurant. So that was his weapon of choice. And he had a list of people who were next to get done by Tim Roth or Kieran Hines, his pack. So he was a man who, once he had decided on all the possibilities of the part, then he could inhabit it. And Marlon Brando was his god. That is how he got into acting. He used to go to the cinema with his best mate, and they were walking home one day from the cinema, having seen Marlon Brando, and they walked past a little tiny theatre in Erith. And his mate said, "Mike, well, that's where they do the acting." And he said, "What, in that building?" And he said, "Yeah, that's where they do it, Michael." And he said, "No, never." And he went in and he started as a carpenter because he was incredibly gifted. And then he said, "I walked on the stage and va-voom." He said, "Maguire, it was like a bolt of lightning. I've found my tribe." And he always said, I always wanted to be behind the curtain in that magical world. That's where I'll inhabit. That's my world. And, you know, many, many people have mentioned how Michael's chosen habitat, if you like, were the corridors and backstage. He was a great company man. He was a peerless storyteller and mischief maker.
Right. I mean, so, I can imagine sort of being backstage, you know, with Gambin or, and that just, it kind of reminds me of how sort of Bob Hoskins sort of wandered into the theatre as well. That was his sort of introduction as well. So was he, yeah. He was theatre through and through, but not a lovey because he hadn't come from that background. And nobody did quiet malice like he did in The Thief, apart from maybe Burkhoff, yeah, but Burkhoff's playing it as only Burkhoff can, you know, to the gallery, look at me, I'm being bad. But there's a quiet malice in a world of lock, stock villains. Go back and watch the listeners. Go back, if you haven't seen it, the Greenway film. He is quite very intimidating indeed.
Yes, he really is. And he has, as you put it so beautifully, this quiet malice, this attention, this focus. And he's able to switch, you know, he's got this mercurial, magical quality where he can be, I mean, it's quite Irish in a way, I think, this magical storytelling ability where you can inhabit different characters. Because he always said that when he went to Dublin, which he loved, and one of his favourite experiences was with one of his greatest directors, Deborah Warner, he managed to go out one day into the countryside and he stood outside this little church hall where they were playing Waiting for Godot. And there were four old men outside smoking. All right, yeah, you're all right there. You're all right. And then someone came on and said, you're on. And he said, the four old men were the characters in the play. And he said, it was the first time in my life I got Beckett completely and brilliantly as it should have been played. So Michael wanted to be an actor like people are taxi drivers. He didn't want to be a love ever.
Here's the thing. This thought just struck me because we're talking about, everybody talks about the Hellraisers, etc. But it's a very male-dominated world. And obviously, you're a lovely lady, and one of his favourite directors is a lovely lady. So therefore, he didn't have that sort of macho chip on his shoulder, did he?
No, he didn't. He was very good with women, very, very kind. He loved Helen Mirren. She was one of his greatest co-stars. He absolutely worshipped her as a performer, and he always said playing Anthony and Cleopatra with her was one of the great experiences. So for him to reprise that later in The Cook was wonderful. I mean, they were very playful and very naughty, of course, with her, all those boys. But she's such a great, great woman as well as an actress. She could hold them off. You know, she was a real inspiration to us younger women at the time. Helen Mirren was just a goddess.
And took no proverbial, did she? That's the whole thing.
No. She's brave, brave, brave. And, you know, to this day, she's still cutting edge. She's wonderful. And Eileen Atkins.
Yes.
Eileen Atkins and Michael go back and they're fantastic friends. Judi Dench, he loved. I mean, occasionally he got smacked by Maggie Smith for, you know, misbehaving. As in Gosford Park, there's the wonderful, wonderful moment where Michael, of course, never read scripts. He didn't like to read scripts. So,
okay, fair enough. That must have been fun for directors. Yeah.
It was, well, if you're Altman, it was fine. But if you're not, I think it was a challenge. But day one, there's a huge dining room scene and he's making googly eyes and blowing kisses at Maggie Smith. And at the end of it, she's going, what the are you doing, yeah. Michael? What are you doing? Mucking about. And he said, you're my wife. I thought I'd just, you know, be affectionate. And she said, no, your wife is Kristin Scott Thomas, not me.
Well, so the thing is, towards the end, as he gets, I was going to say more mature, but never mind. As he gets older, he's got this. He can't hear you. You help him. Explain to the listeners. We've only got 6 minutes. What were you helping with his lines? What was your role, Millie?
So I re-met him in 2010 when he nearly ran me over in his then Bentley, and he said, I'm having problems remembering my lines. We were about to, he was about to start work with David Hare on a film called Page Eight. And the idea is, as an earwig, and people like Johnny Depp use earwigs because, you know, he can get the lines fresh. There's a little earpiece, and then someone like me, an earwig, hides in a cupboard or backstage somewhere with a screen and a microphone, and I preempt what's coming. So Michael's in the scene. You might say to him, lovely day, Michael, beat. I give him his line and he goes, well, if you like rain, whatever the line is, so that I am there to support him and to help guide him through the scene. So he doesn't have to panic about remembering lines.
Would you be giving him the entire line or just like signposts or key words? Because obviously that could be quite...
Michael, it was the entire line.
Right, OK. I mean, how... And he was... I mean, I suppose the thing is, that's his love of still the craft. And he still wants to continue. And he doesn't want to have somebody standing off camera with a huge sort of signboard.
Idiot board.
Yeah.
No. This was much more fluid, so he could remain in the scene and focus in the scene, and then the lines would come just before. I only ever delivered them flat. I didn't give them any intonation because, of course, he had to interpret the line in his own way. So I couldn't suggest any sort of performance, if you like. So it was merely the words just before the line. Other people come in, I then come in. So we built up over this. And in the Winnebago or the green room, we'd practice it. So he absolutely... So I was able to interpret his rhythm so that I would then answer just before. So he was, if you like, in sync with his own performance.
That's an incredible experience to get that close to one of the
fantastic.
Great gambler.
Fantastic.
3.5 minutes, believe it or not, Millie, we've got left. So when you speak to his peers, when you speak to people about Gamden, what, I mean, so many stories, so many tales, so much love, I suppose, really.
Huge love. And what I'd love to say to your listeners is please read the plays. Please go and see Beckett. Please go and see Pinter. Please go and see these wonderful, wonderful classic plays. Harry Potter is a genius piece of work. And of course, it speaks to a generation. But you have to remember that the great J.K. Rowling herself has been influenced by writers before her. Ursula Le Guin, maybe one, Tolkien. So you must also understand it's desperately important to read great works as well as her great work.
And also go to live theatre because that moment when lights go down, curtains open,
go to live theatre whenever you can. Beg, borrow, steal a ticket. Just go. Yes.
So,
thank you so much, Giles.
I haven't finished yet. We've got 2 minutes.
Oh,
don't worry. Thank you for that impassion because I'm absolutely with you on that one. What was it like for you to write this? Because he's no longer, you know, he's gone to the great prompt room in the sky or whatever. I mean, for you to revisit because you've got your own personal thing with him.
It's such a good question because I wanted to democratise Gambon. I wanted people to hear his voice if I can. That's what my aim is with the book, to allow everyone to be able to sit in that dressing room and hear his voice again. So for me to revisit it and to go and see old friends who've been so generous to me, giving me stories, sharing their experiences, actors, writers, directors, producers... That has been the joy of keeping Michael alive. So I feel that as long as we've got people retelling our memories, we're forever alive.
The book is called The Great Gambon, Michael Gambon in his own words and others. It's by Millie Ellis, who we're talking to today. Listeners, you can go to the TRE bookstore, click on the wonderful sort of image of Gambon, and it will be winging its way towards you via a well-known distribution service. Millie, do you get involved with social media? Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. I do. As a voice coach, I have a little company called Be Heard, and I can be found on www.beheard-co.uk. And I'd love to meet anyone who might have to give a speech ever.
Shameless plug. Just give me that the web address for us for Be Heard again, please.
www.be-heard.co.uk. Shameless.
Can I just say that Michael would be proud as punch with your performance, because we've got through, believe it or not, 30 minutes on that one. Isn't time for when you're having fun? So there you go.
Oh, my goodness, Charles, you're so generous. Thank you so, so much.
The pleasure's been all mine. The book's called The Great Gambon. It is by Millie Ellis. Millie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.